man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
How's it going, everybody? It's almost Christmas time, but it's Who Shot Ya?
That was almost good, and then towards the end, I really petered out.
I was not going to jump in and help.
Yeah. I know. I was truly like, okay,
I was trying
Alonzo's
to match your
got
pitch.
My back. But yes, you're listening to Who Shot Ya? And we are in the booth right now. But who's in the booth with me? Well,
who are you?
Look, I was so invested in my Christmas song that I forgot who I am. And I am Iffy Whiteyway, your host, and in the booth with me, film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, well, I'll tell you, Iffy. You know, one of the reasons that I love this most magical time of year is the flavors and the smells. You know, candles and hand soap smell better than they do the rest of the year. And of the many sort of seasonal tastes, I love me some chocolate and peppermint. And right now, no one is delivering that to me with the blunt force efficacy of McConnell's ice cream, who has a seasonal flavor called Reindeer Tracks. Now, McConnell's is a California thing, but I found if you go to their website, they will FedEx it to you, like dry ice or whatever. So it counts as national. But if you live in California, it's easier for you to just get it at your grocery store. Anyway, Reindeer Tracks, deep chocolate ice cream, some major peppermint going on. A delectable combo, and I'm all about it right now.
Ooh. Does Alonzo get extra points for seeing efficacy in the first 2 minutes of the podcast?
Have we met?
I know, yeah. I
feel dumber each minute.
I mean, that's all the time for me. But have you tried that new Coca-Cola cinnamon they've been pushing
on?
I
keep looking for it and can't find it anywhere. I've had the Sprite holiday spice cranberry. It's fine. It's not quite as good as last year's Sprite cranberry, but it's all right. It's all right.
Also, sitting next to me, to my left, is producer and film festival programmer Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Efficacy is good. But what's really good, you guys can probably guess because you know me pretty well. I am someone who keeps a tidy and almost empty inbox. I do not ever have, you know, like I have friends who have numbers in the thousands. And I tell you, I would not sleep. And I also, more than one time, have made them give me their account so I can clear it out for them because the anxiety gives me, like, I take my inbox down to zero at night, just constantly. So what I've discovered recently that gives me so much joy is every morning I go through and I make sure if I get any emails that have the unsubscribe at the bottom, girls, I unsubscribe like a maniac. Like nothing gives me more. It's the best start to your day. Like I unsubscribed from 5 things today. Just like release those tethers. Float free in this world. It's a joy.
You don't need to know about every single Williams-Sonoma sale.
No. I don't need to know about any of them. So yeah, unsubscribe, you guys. It's the way to live.
Yeah, I finally started doing that. Mostly because some of these things, like, I mean, the number one thing, being in L.A., I swear
how many
to
shows?
God, if we are friends and you get my email and I end up on your email list, I'm not going to say anything to you because I'm non-confrontational, but I'm going to unsubscribe and I'm going to look at you in my head in a very weird way.
You're going to give an internal side
eye.
Yeah,
just that internal side eye. But also, like, they'll do the Hollywood Bowl. I went, and I don't know how they got my email, but they'll be like, concerts that you'll be into, and it'll never be an artist that I want.
You just get a lot of...
Iffy, it's Ferranti and Teicher.
Like, I went to the Hollywood Bowl to see Kanye West do an orchestral performance of 808s, and it's like, want to see Michael Bolton? I was like, sure.
I guess. Yeah.
What else is good with you, Iffy, other than Michael Bolton in concert?
What's good with me is, we're getting ready to do the holiday shift. I'm getting ready to buy a tree. You know, this is the first year, like, Naomi's 3 now, so this is the first year she's, like, conscious for a lot of things. I've also learned this is the first year she remembers things. Like, she got scared of my car once because I put her car seat. I shouldn't broadcast that this happened, but I'm already talking about it. I put her car seat in, but I didn't realize because I put it in, like, I had to move it, and then I moved it back, and then I put her in it without buckling it. So I went on a turn, and the car seat tipped over, and I tipped her back over. But now she's like, no, I don't trust you, motherfucker. You drive, like, she didn't associate it to the fact that it wasn't buckled. She associated it to my driving.
Nice.
So, like, she'll just go, slow down. And then when the car stops, she puts her arms out and goes, stop. I'm like, that's not doing anything. You're being extra.
But she's excited about the decorations?
Yeah, because, like, now that she's, like, going to this, like, preschool, they teach her about all the seasons. So, like, it was very scary during Halloween because she would just point to things and go, haunted. like, that was what, and I was like, this is terrifying. So today's show, we're talking about The Irishman, and we'll talk about our favorite food scenes in film and staff picks. But first, since 2019 is wrapping up and it is the day after Thanksgiving, we're going to anoint a select few with the prestigious title Turkeys of the Year. This can be a movie, an actor, a director, anything you feel did not live up to its full potential. It can also be a trend that has worn out its welcome. There's no real criteria, and we'll have no limit to the amount of turkey titles we can hand out. So let's begin with the official Who Shot Ya Turkeys of the Year. Alonzo, why don't you begin?
I think I'm going to bestow one of these on the Walt Disney Company.
Ooh.
Look, they do a lot right, and, you know, I'm watching The Mandalorian. This is not like a screed against everything they do. But their acquisition of Fox, I think, has sort of underlined a lot of corporate policies they have that kind of suck and that now are going to have much bigger ramifications. Specifically, their unwillingness to let catalog titles circulate and be screened in non-theatrical settings and in by repertory theaters, which is really kind of choking out a lot of smaller independent theaters that really kind of rely on, you know, showing old movies, you know, bringing back the classics. And coupled with this whole discussion now of possibly overturning the Paramount ruling and allowing studios to get back into the movie theater business, none of this bodes well for smaller films, smaller distributors, smaller theatrical chains. And so, you know, yes, we're all thrilled that the X-Men can now be in the Avengers movies. Calm down. But there's a lot also that's very kind of worrisome about this thing, and I just hope that it doesn't get worse as we go along.
Oh, so rarely the things we worry about get worse.
No.
When does that ever happen?
Heavens no.
I'll jump back. Jump off of that one? Jump back!
Jump back, kiss yourself.
Yes. Dark Phoenix was such a turkey for me, not just because it was a relatively disappointing film in and of itself, but also for the kind of the whimper of which it ended that franchise, the idea that they had something so female-led and that they had built up all these characters, and it's really hard. When I'm someone who's so heavily invested in indie film, and so the few... No, I give my heart to big films all the time, but that one I just was like, you guys had so much possibility here. You had years of people who love the Dark Phoenix storyline. You have people who are new to it. There was so much potential, and to have it sizzle out in that way, it was like very uniquely upsetting. It was worse than... There are other commercial, like Hellboy was a commercial disappointment, but I don't think people had the same kind of hopes pinned on it, or people like me, that they did with Dark Phoenix.
And where's that New Mutants movie?
Right. Oh, yeah, RIP that.
Oh, man. I think, kind of jumping off of your jump off.
Yes. You guys just
I
keep
will
jumping.
Take this right, and I'm going to go, my turkey is going straight to online nerdy film Twitter, and we're gonna get there. It's gonna be a walk, but we're gonna get there. So there has been good outrage online, like the one versus Sonic, and then we saw that there was the change that the nerds liked. But now, you know, and by the time this release, this might have been come into fruition, but you've noticed that all the stars from Justice League have joined in on the release, the Snyder Cut.
Oh, God.
So much so that one might believe that it is a social media campaign at this point, which means that the studio is going to give in and release a Snyder Cut. And I think that is a dangerous precedent when you tell nerds that they can win if they pester enough people online.
Oh, yeah. No, one of the worst things about the internet era is the idea that fans have a say in anything.
Yes.
You know, like it's an entire internet of Annie Wilkes's tying, you know, their favorite franchises to the bed and threatening to hobble them, basically. Yeah, no, I'm not down for that at all. I find this, yeah, you're right, it is very fishy. It's like, first of all, if we thought that Warner Brothers had it lying around, like, wouldn't they have released it by now?
Oh, yeah.
Like, haven't they taken enough of a bath on this thing that it's like, all right, well, this thing exists. We'll just put it out on streaming or whatever.
Yeah.
Open it. We'll do a Fathom event, something. It seems to me like if this magical confluence existed and this legendary cut existed, that we'd have seen it by now.
Well, here's my
theory. If you invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook.
Yeah. Well, my theory is that with all this fan hubbub and all this, they actually had Snyder come in and do another. Like, I think they made it. Like, it never existed, but now they made it, which is its own slew of problems because it's this idea of, like, I mean, if you can imagine going back even 10, 20 years and being like, people are going to ask for a specific cut of a movie. Like, can you imagine even thinking the idea and the entitlement beyond that? It's like, you got what you got.
Well, there is precedent for wanting a director's cut of something, especially if it's like an auteur and the studio came in and made a mess of it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there was like a history of, I feel like Heaven's Gate was a whole nightmare, but wasn't there the implication that there was a better edit
there,
of
there
it
is a
somewhere?
Director's cut that eventually surfaced that some people claim makes it a better movie.
So the difference is with those, like with, to me, presumably, a Snyder cut also involves intensive additional special effects and visual elements that it's a whole different range of.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
it's not like you were competing edits in studio audiences.
I mean, look, and I'm a believer in director's cuts. Certainly, like, I'm thrilled that, like, we're finally getting from Criterion, I believe in December, the Wim Wenders 5-hour cut of Until the End of the World, which I think really is a market improvement over the 2.5-hour theatrical version. You know, we finally, you know, I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but Orson Welles's long thought dead, you know, Other Side of the Wind now exists thanks to Netflix and all the other people that worked so hard to put it together. But it's like, I mean, sure, I'll see it. But on paper, there is nothing about the other Zack Snyder superhero movies that makes you think that this one is going to be the special one.
And that's my final point on this is like, that's why I didn't see it, but I will watch both in succession to be like, oh, no, they're both bad. I can get, you know, I'm just not into that vision. I'm not into, and I don't think that Whedon messed it up.
Jumping off of that.
No, we're Cirque du Soleil.
The idea, guys, I'm just up here aerialisting all over the place. The idea of executives making amazing calls. The so far unknown exec that suggested back in the development phase that Julia Roberts might be an interesting candidate to play Harriet Tubman.
Oh, man.
I'd like to give that executive a turkey.
Yeah, that's all yours. An extra big one, too. A juicy turkey.
I feel bad for Julia Roberts getting pulled into all of that only because she's like, whoa, I didn't tell them to say my name.
Yes.
Don't put me next to this.
This is like a joke out of The Player.
No, fully.
Where like every time something gets pitched, it's like, oh, for Julia Roberts.
Yeah. I'd love to give a big fat turkey to Tyrese. Tyrese is getting one. As you may or may not know, if you're within following the Fast franchise, he was not happy with Hobbs versus Shaw releasing. It actually caused a huge spat between him and The Rock online because he admittedly was going through a lot of like life problems at the time and really, it's his own words that he could have used the money of another movie that year, but instead they're doing a side project and splitting away from like the Fast family and doing his own thing was bad. Then when Hobbs and Shaw released, he like made a post kind of mocking it for doing poorly, when actually it turned out it didn't do that bad.
No.
Like, the overseas numbers were pretty well. So he got his numbers mixed up, but did a taunting post tagging The Rock that was, like, deleted within 30 minutes. But I'm going to give you a turkey because I did see that, Tyrese.
So this is, like, the angry bass player who's pissed off about the successful solo career.
Oh, yes.
Who's also not fully recognizes his relevance entirely depends on the successful solo career.
Yeah. Oh,
Oh, bless his heart.
I don't want to give a turkey to the American film going public per se, but I do have to say, and I know we talked about this last week, I'm still annoyed about the chilly reception given to Charlie's Angels. I had a blast of that movie, and I think it as I said on Twitter, I would rather live in the dimension where we get more Charlie's Angels and White House Down movies instead of Kingsman and Has Fallen. But, you know, here we are. But even worse than the movie, that movie not doing well, because movies I like don't do well all the time, is the extrapolation of that into, oh, well, because it was too woke or it was too womanly or it was too whatever. It's like, no. Movies fail all the time, and they only fail because of that crap when they are movies that are centered on women or queer people or people of color. And when white guy movies fail, oh well, oops, we move on, and love those white guys are gonna make another 10 movies.
Yeah, those white guys move on to do the next Star Trek,
for instance.
Good. I feel good about those turkeys, you guys.
Yeah.
Well stuffed.
Ooh, well stuffed. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about The Irishman just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
This week on Bullseye, Lin-Manuel Miranda on His Dark Materials, hip-hop, and life after Hamilton.
I know it's the first line of my obituary, so if that line is handled, then what else can I do with my time here?
It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today, we're talking about The Irishman.
Irishman.
Yeah, man. Irishman works, but I feel like in my head, I put an E there. Alonzo, could you please give us a quick synopsis of the film?
Your head is a frightening place sometimes, Ify. Sure. So Robert De Niro plays Frank Sheeran, who is a guy who we meet as a truck driver, later gets ingratiated with elements of organized crime and becomes a hitman, or as the parlance of the film, a house painter. In fact, the original title of the book that this is based on, and the original title of the movie is
I heard you paint houses.
And they leave that title in at the beginning, which I was like, oh, what a Godardian touch. And they thought, oh, no, they just didn't get rid of the old title sequence. Okay, fine. Anyway, so over the course of the 20th century, he, like I said, gets involved with organized crime, which involves becoming kind of wingman to a very popular and very controversial Teamsters chief, Jimmy Hoffa, played by Al Pacino. And Sheeran eventually kind of tells the story of what the hell happened to Jimmy Hoffa, which has been one of sort of the great unsolved mysteries of the 20th century. Granted, it's his version. Who the hell knows? But, you know, it seems plausible.
Prove him wrong.
Exactly. And over the course of the film, it is, you know, Martin Scorsese sort of once again exploring the flash, but also the tragedy of mob life. And I think this time really kind of taking it to more of an extreme, in that it is about the effect of getting old in a world where everybody around you dies violently and the work that you do drives away the people you love. It's an even more depressing Goodfellas.
It's a really good synopsis.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For a 3.5 hour film, I think it's important to say.
Oh yeah, no, that
really
film
got in a lot.
Was long, but how did y'all feel about the de-aging stuff?
For the most part, it was funny because I was not really aware of it. There's like one part where he's like outside a truck at his youngest.
Yes.
Where I was very worried because it's the first sort of time you see it. And I'm like, yo, this is a Polar Express moment and I'm not going to be happy with all of this. But once they just, the only problem with the de-aging part for me is that apparently those men just look the same age to me all the time. So like, I really couldn't tell a difference from them from sort of their 40s till their 90s. Yeah, maybe when they're very oldest in like the wheelchair and stuff, but
it's a matter of gradations, you know, but it worked a lot better than I thought. Like I kind of went in with one eye cocked, like, all right, what are we doing here? There's like one conversation between Pacino and De Niro that sort of like shot counter shot, is that the term? And where like where Pacino is talking and you see sort of the like a quarter of De Niro's head, and that part looked a little weird for a second, but apart from that I was like, oh wow, you really made this work, you know. And
so
for as much as obviously the, you know, we've had this ongoing conversation about Martin Scorsese and Marvel movies, I think Marvel movies have really done a lot to move this
technology
forward because of like Michael Douglas and the Ant-Man films and you know other characters who've had to kind of run the gamut of you know where they are in the timeline.
And we also talked earlier about one of the things I thought before seeing this that was unfortunate was the loss of the possibility of them casting younger actors and what that could have done. But seeing it all together, it's sort of linear until it's not. And there's enough jumping about that I do think it would have, you would have been lost. Just like you would have had to invest in more characters rather than feeling like it was the same person. So I retract my earlier concern about that because I do think the structure of the movie wouldn't have offered that.
And speaking of that structure, sorry, freshman film students, do not try this at home. Like, Scorsese pulls off, like, flashbacks within flashbacks. And, like, all this stuff that you are just not supposed to do. But when you are written...
The thing is, it's also wall-to-wall narration.
Yes.
There's more voiceover than,
all
like,
these things you're not supposed to do.
Commercial.
But, like, Steven Zaillian wrote it and Martin Scorsese directed it, and they know exactly what they're doing, and they know how to, like, make that work. Well,
do they?
Well, we can get into that. But I'm just saying, like, this is not...
Sure. Yeah. It's not beginner level.
This is advanced, exactly.
Yeah, definitely.
Did any of the de-aging...
No, I was on the same boat as you, where when I first saw it, I was like, uh-oh. And then, like, right after that scene, it just clicked. Like, I just, for, like, reading it here, I was like, oh, yeah, they were de-aged, you know? I think the only thing was towards the end when it swapped from them being young to them being old, I'm like, oh, Al Pacino's not long for this world, and I'm sad about it. Like, it really just lets you realize how old he is when you see a younger version of him. It's like, by the way, this is how old I am, though.
I felt, The other hang-up on the age thing was the minute, so Joe Pesci, who to me is the standout of this.
Yes. He's
the best performance by far.
Oh, my God,
And it's also because it's, to me, unlike what I've seen him do before, it's a different energy, and it's so committed and thorough. But also, he in real life is the exact same age as De Niro, and in this, he's meant to be his elder. Mm. So he refers to De Niro as kid, and you're like... So in my head, there was no ever bouncing past that. Like, to me, I'm like, I don't have it in me. Whatever it is, they looked, other than that very brief Polar Express moment, I was like, you two look the same age. You keep calling him kid. It is very, very funny to me.
Oh,
it was nice unexpected humor.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of unexpected humor, this movie was a lot more funny than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I was laughing so much. There's just so many fun moments. I mean, even playing with like the things they set up, like throughout the movie, you'll see certain mobsters and you'll learn their fate. It'll say their name and how they die. And there's just one mobster that it's a joke. I actually stopped on that where I was like, I don't want to give it away. But there's a really funny joke on like what happens to one mobster that really made me laugh.
There's a lot of like kind of mordant wit to the film. Like there's a whole running thing involving De Niro getting involved with somebody whose mob name is Whispers, but he's the other Whispers.
And this one was the good Whispers.
Yeah, you know, just like all this kind of stuff going back and forth. There's a scene toward the end with Jesse Plemons involving a wet spot in the back seat of a car and a frozen fish.
It just
keeps going and going.
I was like, I will give $10 if I don't have to hear any of these men say the word fish. I'm dying.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was great. Shout out to Jesse Plemons. He's like so pleasantly, like, and he always walks that fine line of either he's a doof where he's terrifying. Because I think of his character in Breaking Bad where it's like, oh, you're dumb, but you're like terrifying and dumb. And this,
I'll say that due for terrifying is pretty much the vibe I got from every single man in this movie. Like, honestly, all of them. That was one of my problems with it is I had zero interest in any, there's two characters total that I was interested in. I didn't have interest in most of them. And as a result, it got better towards the end, but like, man, I was checking my time so much. I was like, just stay for 30 more minutes. You're not going to get in trouble if you leave. You can do 30 and you can do anything for 30. And then like, I'd wait and then I'd check it again. And that's how I made it all the way through the movie. Wow. And I finally got to a point where I stopped checking so much. So I knew I was like, but maybe it's also, I felt I was near the end, but the do for the vicious is part of it is in this world that's set up, that not a single one of these guys did I get any feeling off of them other than greed or macho posturing. And I know that's part of the commentary by the end, like Alonzo said nicely, that, you know, one of the biggest, and that's why I liked the end of it the best, is one of the things you're getting is this reflection of men on how they've lived their lives and was it worth it. But for me, because it didn't spend a lot of time on the Flash. Like Goodfellas, like the other gangster movies, I'm like, sure, you're drowning in cocaine. I could see why that would be great.
Yeah.
But this one, I'm like, it never looked great. And it never looked like it was fun. I also, it was a weird centering everything around the Irishman because he's by far the most mediocre out of all of them. I didn't get any wit or charisma. Like he has loyalty, which is required of all of them. Like that seemed like his strongest asset, but I never saw other than him like sticking with people. Like, why am I following? He's like the Forrest Gump of ending up near like big things happening in the world.
Well, I think that it reminded me a lot of Wolf of Wall Street, where you have these guys who are not like geniuses and they are not like reshaping the world. They are just grubby and they're just like grubbing for everything they can get their hands on.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you had to keep explaining to people about Wolf of Wall Street that these people are, Scorsese is not glorifying these characters. Right. He's showing them to you as they are. And I think he's very much doing that here. Like, there's nothing, you know, these are not criminal masterminds. They're just like guys who like work their way up from like being hoods to being, you know, dudes in, you know, sleek suits, but are still hoods ultimately, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I kind of liked the fact that I liked the mundaneness of it. Like, I like that car trip where no one has anything particularly interesting to say, but the women just smoke a lot and wear poochie pantsuits, you know? I never looked at my watch once.
Yeah.
Like, and I never thought about like going to the bathroom. Like, I was in it. And as it gets toward the end, I think so much of it is about aging and deterioration and regret. I found that really fascinating, kind of like we were talking about with Pain and Glory. Like, these are issues I don't think that filmmakers often want to address. And so this idea of like, yeah, I did this thing and it seemed like the thing that I do at the time. And, you know, it gave me a certain jolt of power to be able to like go beat up the grocer because he was mean to my daughter or whatever. But by the end of your life, no one is there for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you have nothing to show for it. And everybody you worked with got gunned down in a driveway somewhere and your family didn't want to talk to you.
Yeah, like that's kind of how I took it, too, is to use The Wolf of Wall Street for an example. I think
I've not seen that. Full disclosure.
The general thing I was going to take from it is that there are two types of people that watch it. There are the people who watch it and realizes that all these men are bad and, you know, this is a view on like how they are bad. And then you have like dumb bros who are like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes this cool is it uses that device where I think dumb bros would look at, and no offense to the dumb bros who,
bless you. I love a dumb bro. Sure.
But like, I think somebody sees that as cool as like a guy who gets something done. He's gonna get it done. It doesn't matter. Like, he does no flash about him. He's gonna get it done, and that's why you hire him, because I'm the guy who gets it done. And then you see that getting it done all the time for these people who shouldn't matter to you more than your family. You know, like he really did put these people above him when like, in a way, he's always been an other to him. Like, even when they give him the ring, he's like, you're the only Irishman to have this. Like, and that really stuck out to me, because there is that there's something to that of like you had like somebody like Hoffa who like really did like I think they really did bond as friends, and you had the family who like the daughter was giving him signs right away like I don't like this guy, like I see through.
She's one of the two characters I was interested
in. Like, no. Like I don't, and that's one thing too is I wish we got to see more of the of that like push and pull of his daughter's relationship just to make that
for
scene.
Sure. The daughter we see young. And then as an older woman, as a no longer a child, oh, adult, that's the word for that, is played by Anna Paquin. And she's great. Both her and the younger girl have the most suspicious eyes you've ever seen.
They are giving so much face in this movie.
It's so good.
Like everybody who complains about how they don't have enough dialogue.
I still think
you don't need dialogue when you're given that much face.
I don't think that what she was doing didn't come across without dialogue because she's giving beautiful face with a lot of intent. But she, again, to me, was way more interested. I was like, oh, we're going to get more of the family now because that's interesting to me. These men are uninteresting. Their lives are stupid. Like, they're like, oh, I got a gun and this guy threatened me. And, like, to me, it exacerbated it by having, like, when we introduce all the people and we have on screen it written, this is Big Tony. He's going to die in 1980 from a gunshot head. I'm like, yeah, they all are. I get it. They're fucking morons. So what I wanted was never given to me. I wanted to know more about the family stuff. And I also felt it was kind of clumsily handled because there's a scene, we never have a scene with Anna Paquin, but you have a scene later with another daughter you've never seen before. You aren't even really sure he has more daughters. And she has this like, you don't know how it was for us. I'm like, exactly. Like, why are you having this conversation? But the one character that I would have happily watched 3.5 hours got two lines. They were both pull over so I can smoke, which was
Joe Pesci's wife,
who the four things I know about, she's beautiful, she loves to smoke, she's like a mobster royalty, she gets a whole voiceover of like, she's from the Sciamma family in Sicily, she's longtime mobster, fascinating, and she can't have children. And I was like, though that combination, I want to know what this woman thinks of this world. She's clearly supports her husband Pesci in this weird way. More interested in her than a single dude we came across.
I did love both.
And I got nothing about her.
Both the women in the backseat, Catherine Narducci, who plays Pesci's wife, and then De Niro's second wife, who is played by Stephanie Kurtzuba. Who did y'all think that was? Just out of curiosity.
I thought the women were interchangeable and I could not tell them apart.
Because I spent the entire movie convinced from her first appearance that that was Marissa Tomei. I was sure of it.
Oh, and hilarious.
Then, yes. And then I did the review on Breakfast All Day with Crystal Mir. She goes, no, that was Cara Buono. And I'm like, no, it wasn't her either. It was.
That's what I'm saying. Cara Buono, like,
was
the first
Kurtzuba.
Wife. You couldn't tell apart the wives. Oh, it was very frustrating for me.
But anyway, Stephanie Kurtzuba, you're amazing. I want to see you in other things.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm not trying to discredit them. They were just styled the same.
But
they all look the same.
I hear what you're saying,
story.
But I think that Scorsese would answer you with the idea that...
With something condescending?
No, maybe. I can't speak for that. But
that's fair.
I think the idea is... I think the movie is, in a way, kind of handling the women the way the men did, which is like, put them to the side, have them be attractive, not really ever ask them a question or be interested in their input, you know?
That's a good point.
And I don't think that... And I think the movie agrees with you that, yeah, these guys are dull and that they aren't, like, you know, these captains of industry or whatever, but they do reflect so much of like how shit gets done in this country. I mean, like Jimmy Hoffa, for all of his ridiculousness as presented in this movie, like was this super powerful labor union leader at a time when labor unions held a lot more clout in this country than they do now. And I mean, I think the macho posturing is, it is obviously an ongoing concern of Scorsese, and I think it's hilarious the way that he skewers it. That whole, the sit down in Miami.
Yeah, oh yeah. Like the way I kind of envisioned it to address what you were saying earlier is that we're looking at this movie through the lens of the Irishman, and I think that was, like, I was looking at it as like, oh, like we're supposed to yearn for more family because, like, why are we paying attention to these guys? You're losing your family, you're losing, like, the people in your life, but he's like, no. I got to impress this old, aging Italian guy. I need him to love me.
Yeah.
But it was great to have Pesci back. Like, you know.
So good.
There are so few people who could be in movies and just don't feel like it.
Yeah.
You know, or just like.
Or there's also so many people who, like, who should take a graceful out.
Well,
and
exactly.
Don't.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're used to. You know, right. We're used to the ones who just will not go away, or like will keep clinging on to whatever it is. You know, and they're in every like direct to streaming. You know, or you know, kind of cruddy cable, whatever. But
Hallmark
like
Christmas.
I wasn't going to say that, but you know, a case could be made. But no, but like Pesci is like, yeah, I'm just not interested. And then Scorsese comes and he's like, oh, all right for you, Marty, you know. And yeah, he's brilliant in this.
He was so good.
All right, so let's go ahead and give our final review of The Irishman. Would you screen it, stream it, or skip it?
I would say if you are someone who likes mobster gangster movies, that I would say stream it. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you're fine skipping it.
Ooh.
Wow.
I do think there's beautiful, I mean, it's impeccable craftsmanship. You can't say anything about that. But as someone who I just.
Edited by the great Thelma Schoonmaker.
It's shot gorgeously. It's period piece. It's great. I would have been happy to never have seen this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Not like I hated it. Just no.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, here's the thing. I definitely say screen it. One of my favorite films of the year. I absolutely love it. However, I'm not going to be one of those D-bags who's like, oh, you have to see it on the big screen, because I know how it goes with Netflix movies, and you have major theater chains who will not screen their stuff.
Right.
And so for a lot of people listening to this, screening it is not going to be an option because it is now on Netflix, and Netflix is your choice. So when I say screen it, I mean in the parlance of this show, it means I love the movie,
right. But
it also means if you got to watch it on Netflix, watch it on Netflix, but like really make an effort to give it your full attention, dim the lights,
for sure.
Turn off your phone, don't look at your laptop, like, because this is 3.5 hours. You are making an investment of time, but I think it's a worthwhile investment, and I think it's one that requires a little effort on your part to sort of be there for it as it goes along.
Yeah, I'm going to like plus one that, and I definitely am going to go with screen it. It is a long movie. And you will start washing dishes. Like, it'll be, because, you know, the ebbs and flows, because the movie's pacing is like beautifully artful. And I feel like that, for a lot of people, only works in the theater. Like, a movie with slow pacing, you're like, all right, I'm going to check my phone, and then you're gone.
Yeah.
This movie, like, you have to let it suck you in. And it sucked me in because I saw this with producer Casey at the Alamo Draft House, legs kicked up, chomping down on a big burger.
Were there nachos involved?
Yeah, I know. I was like, I feel bad because I'm like crunching, and the lady's next to me, I don't know if she's in the splash zone because that was a juicy burger. But yeah.
It's like a Gallagher show. Everybody around you gets a tarp.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, please check the movie out. I enjoyed it. But we will be right back. But first, we have to hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Hey, it's Jesse Thorne. We're very happy to announce that tickets for Max FunCon 2020 will go on sale Friday, November 29th at 11 a.m. Pacific. I also want to let you know, this coming year, Max FunCon 2020 will be our last Max FunCon for the foreseeable future. For 2020 and beyond, we're going to be looking for ways to connect with more of you in person and spread the spirit of Max Fun farther than it's ever gone before. In the meantime, if you want to join us at the last Max Fun Con in Lake Arrowhead, June 12th through the 14th, you can find details at maxfuncon.com.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Drea Clark.
And since it's the day after Thanksgiving and we're all stuffed with food, we're going to talk about the most memorable food scenes in films. This was actually inspired by a listener-submitted question from Alan and Savannah. So thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
All right. So we're going to talk about which food in the movies looked delicious, which food looked disgusting, and what are the best food movies. And we're going to cover all that right now. Let's start with Alonzo.
Oh, so many to name. Yeah. I mean, like, the first movie I remember seeing in a theater was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yes.
And now somebody actually makes a gummy bear the size of your head.
Yes.
And I want one just to have that moment like Viola Beauregard, yes, where she picks it off the branch and just sticks her whole face in it, you know.
The best part in Willy Wonka is the, to me, the eating part is when he takes the teacup that's a flower and he drinks like hot cocoa out of it and then he eats the teacup.
Yeah. Yes. It's so totally. Good. So that's a great one. I mean, Babette's Feast is one of my favorite movies, sure. And that's a meal I would love to sit down for at some point. This is a weird one. Do you guys remember Billy Crystal's directorial effort, Mr. Saturday Night?
No.
He plays a comedian like who's popular in the 50s on like live TV and stuff, and then like all the way up until the 90s where he's like old and, you know, wrinkly and a pain in the ass. The opening credits sequence is directed by Saul Bass. It's like one of the last things Saul Bass did. And the whole thing is like, I don't know if it's a... What's the big, is it, it's not Passover, what's the big like Jewish eating holiday?
Sukkot or?
Sukkot.
Sukkot, thank you.
Anyway, it is this table that Sukkot. Is just like bursting with, you know, like brisket and challah and all this stuff. And all you hear is like people trading stories and jokes back and forth. And like, it's the idea of like, this is the where Jewish comedians come from, is these dinner table
Amazing.
Chats, you know?
Yeah.
And just that, the movie is whatever, but that whole opening sequence with just the dinner table stuff is so great.
Well, one of the best opening sequences is Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, which is, it starts with, and it's my favorite use. It's like when they have a piano playing actor and they'll show like their face and then they'll cut to different hands on the keys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this has that, but like cooking wise, but it starts with someone like literally like getting a fish out of a stream or an ice thing. And then you're like, oh, I'm watching them scale a fish. Oh, I'm watching a fish be butchered. Oh, but then it goes into the most beautiful knife work with, and it's a Chinese chef and this cleaver, and he's doing the most beautiful fine-tuned knife work with the biggest ass knife you've ever seen, and the result is like this huge sumptuous feast.
Ooh. Well, the great Asian cooking movie, well, of course, is Tampopo, yeah. Which is this. Do you know this movie?
No.
Oh my god, you would love it. It's really funny movie about ramen, basically, okay. But about food in general and about, you know, all these things. But the main story is about this like this truck driver who's very sort of Clint Eastwood-esque. Teaching this young widow how to become like a great ramen chef. And so you go through this, all this kind of like very sort of Rocky style montages of like carrying the water and like figuring out how to get the noodles right and stuff. But then it kind of just goes off in these other tangents, like there's this gangster and a girlfriend. And there's like, here's a one-off gag about like people ordering lunch at a business thing. But it is so much about food and the space that food occupies in our lives. And by the end of it, you want like the largest bowl of ramen anybody has,
oh,
just cram it all in your mouth.
Yes. I think if you allow me to get a little animated for this one,
yes.
The Pizza and Goofy movie is still undefeated as the best the pizza in film. It's very cheesy.
Thank you, because all I can think of is Pizza the Hut in Spaceballs, which I hate and gave me nightmares for years. So please tell me more about the Pizza and Goofy movie.
The classic cartoon thing of grabbing a slice and then the cheese is still connected and it's very rubbery. And I remember when I was like in my early 20s, I was in this hunt for like a cheesy, because I had a pizza once that did that, and I was like, I need another cartoon cheesy pizza.
And yet when you go to Disneyland, the pizza is branded at Pizza Planet from Toy Story and not Goofy movie.
How obnoxious. I will say, animated wise, and obviously because it's a cookie movie, but Ratatouille.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, great cooking in it, and Remy steering him with his hair.
Yeah.
But the scene with the flashback in it where the critic eats the actual ratatouille and it takes him back to his childhood and he has like this very emotional response, I love, because I think that is something that cooking and, you know, good food brings out. But my favorite sort of visceral food scene in a movie is from Hook, when they have the food fight and it starts, it's like empty table and they just have to like imagine food, and it's all these like starving lost boys and they imagine, and then at some point it like manifests and is actually there. And it's, but I feel there's a sort of in between of like almost clay, like they have all these bright colored things and they're eating and throwing and it's so magical.
Yeah.
There is a Christmas movie
You've seen it.
I have, that I like quite a bit, called This Christmas. It is a great like ensemble comedy. Idris Elba and Regina King and Loretta Devine and Delroy Lindo and Chris Brown. And And, you know, and it's about this family getting together at Christmas time, you know, in Los Angeles. And, like, it's one of the only movies I've ever seen that actually addresses the notion of, like, you know, yeah, there's the big Christmas dinner. Who's going to make dinner the night before?
Yeah.
You know, and so that becomes a disaster when, like, the sister who cannot cook takes over. But, like, the movie, like, there's a lot of great family dinner scenes in it. And then at the end, when they finally get to the big Christmas dinner, the camera is just, like, over the table, just tracking from one side to the other. And it's just plate after plate of, like, you know, the ham and the mac and cheese. Ooh. And all this, like, getting passed back and forth. And it's just, you know, I love that. And then also, a couple of years ago, we had that movie, Almost Christmas, with Danny Glover and Monique. Mm. And one of the subplots of the film is Danny Glover attempting to recreate the sweet potato pie that his recently deceased wife would make every Christmas, and going through all these different versions where he finally hits on it. And it really captures that notion of, like you were saying, how you can take a bite of something and it just transports to somewhere else, to another time, to your own youth, or to the people who love you, who made it for you. And yeah, I love when a movie can capture that kind of thing.
Yeah. The one scene that always sticks out to me that I think like about way too much, because, and it's not even that big of a showcasing food scene, and it's more in the performance of eating the food, but the scene in The Matrix where he's eating the steak.
Yes!
And he's like, this steak, I know it's not real, but it tastes real. And he's like, I've never seen someone enjoy a steak so much.
You saw Bobby Cannavale in Ashton.
Oh, yeah. The steaks. Oh. And then a movie that it's a great film in a lot of ways, but like the food presentation is either insanely gorgeous and perfectly art directed or horrifically like bile inducing, and that is Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, which runs the full gamut and even like manages to stop over into cannibalism at some point.
As any good food journey should.
You know, it's all part of the life's rich pageant.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Soul Food.
Yes.
In that opening. Oh, with, yeah. You know, you got your greens, your yams, your
Jamon with very young Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem.
Doesn't Volver, she plays...
Yes, some good cooking in that movie too. But Jamon has one of the most epic paellas I've ever seen in a movie.
Oh, I love that epic paella.
It's like they're literally stirring it with what looks like a boat oar.
Yes.
All right. Well, those were our picks. Those were our food movies. But now it's time for a little segment that fills everyone's heart with a warm and cozy feeling. And it's the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. Our Christmas Zaddy, Alonzo Duralde, who has written the book on Christmas, is called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. You can go buy that. But he's about to lay down the law and quickly list all the Christmas movies he's seen in this past week in under a minute. We're recording this episode a week early, so we're actually going to have Alonzo call in from the future to tell us what movies he's watched this week.
I know. I'm going to time travel. It's very exciting.
But, of course, like I said before, Alonzo has a book out about Christmas called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. Go buy it now.
It's such a great stocking stuffer, y'all. Seriously.
Seriously. Okay, here's Alonzo calling in.
Hi, everybody. It's Alonzo calling in from Thanksgiving break with this week's Christmas Zaddy Christmas Minute. You ready for Rooster Casey? Let's go. Okay, so the night before Christmas, it's Vanessa Hudgens and Netflix. Not nearly as good as Princess Switch, but she's adorable and it's cute enough. It's okay. It's fine. Holiday Hearts, wow. Two of my favorite Hallmark people, Ashley Williams and Paul Campbell. Movie is kind of a dud, though, but they definitely try their hardest to make it work. Twinkle All the Way, you know, this is a movie that has a gay couple in it, and it ends with the two of them having a little peck on the mouth, so that's nice. Thank you for that, Lifetime. Otherwise, the movie was kind of a snooze, except for Leslie Ann Warren, who's always great. Carol's Christmas, as own movies go, better than the one from last week. Kimberly Elise is committing. It's always good to see her in Jack A. It was fine, whatever. Cherished Memories, Gift to Remember 2. Big fan of Gift to Remember. I like this one, too, even though they changed dogs on us, but otherwise, quite lovely. Christmas Bells on BET. Kind of a mess, but Raven Goodwin's really funny. Otherwise, though, kind of not great. And then Christmas Recipe for Romance and A Sweet Christmas Romance are both about women who don't cook entering cooking competitions. And Christmas Recipe for Romance on Lifetime was better because it has Loretta Devine.
All right, Alonzo, you went a little hard there.
I totally disagree on all of those, Alonzo, from the future.
I know. Ugh, we don't like future Alonzo. But it is time for our staff picks. It could be any movies, in theaters, streaming, what have you. Drea, why don't you please start us off?
I would be delighted to. Thanks for asking. Finally, we're getting to that point where there's some great things coming out in the theater. And a lot of those are big ones with a lot of marketing. So I'm going to sort of brush past those because presumably their teams are doing the work for me. And instead, when I was thinking of a movie that was concentrated on like similar to The Irishman, but entirely different. One man, his journey through his life and what he was trying to bring into the world and the darkness that came with that. The film that I would recommend is McQueen, the documentary about Alexander McQueen, the fashion designer. It's fantastic. It's engrossing in ways you will not expect. Even if you aren't into fashion, I highly recommend it. One of the collections that he talks about in good detail is inspired by Jack the Ripper, and there's a lot of weird and unexpected darkness and hauntedness to it. But it's such a good documentary and such a good insight into the complexities of a person, which is what I love in my movies. So, McQueen.
Mine is one that I did not mention in the Christmas Minute because I wanted to give it a little bit of a platform. And it ties into the food question because it's a very food-centric film. It's a new indie comedy called Feast of the Seven Fishes. And it is set in 1983. It's Christmas time. It's the Rust Belt. You have a guy played by Skylar Gisondo from Booksmart who he worked in his parents' store, but he longs to be an artist and he's gotten into art school, but he doesn't know if the family's going to go for it when he tells them. He meets a girl who's home for Christmas break, played by Madison Eisman from the last Annabelle movie. She's an Ivy Leaguer, grew up in the town, but went off to private school, so nobody really knows her. And they hit it off. And it's a lovely love story, but that love story is really kind of only a portion of the film because so much of it is just about his sort of rambling Italian family and all the preparation involved in getting together the titular Feast of the Seven Fishes for Christmas. So you've got like Joe Pantoliano and Lynn Cohen and all these amazing character actors, and they are scaling fish and changing the water for the cod, and nice. They're, you know, stuffing the squid and doing all the stuff to get this thing ready. So food is being discussed constantly, but it's a very funny movie. And it took me back to a lot of my own sort of like childhood stuff. Like, you know, I think if your parents or grandparents were immigrants, there's a lot in this movie that you're going to find funny. And it's not even things where it's like it's a one-liner. It's just the mood that they capture of, you know, these sort of noisy, like loving, but also kind of like, you know, confrontational families. I liked it a great deal. So it's currently streaming. It's coming out on Blu-ray in December. Shout Factory's putting it out. So if you're looking for a new Christmas movie that's kind of fun, check out Feast of the Seven Fishes.
Ooh, nice.
Well, speaking of feasts, I think I'm just going to do a callback for my staff pick and have y'all check out Soul Food if you haven't. I mean, I think it's a great look at like the dynamic of a lot of black families. I think that's why it was so successful in the time, and kind of just like it circles around this matriarch who has these Sunday cookouts for the whole family. And really, you know, one thing I was thinking about when I was thinking about saying this is you would think that, you know, everyone kind of assumes that Tyler Perry wrote the book on dysfunctional black families when Soul Food did it first. But congrats to Tyler Perry and his studio in Atlanta. Pay your people fair rate with fair wages. But yeah,
unions are not a bad thing.
Yeah, please, or we'll have to get all Jimmy Hoffa on you. Oh, that's a perfect segue to 5-star segue. Now it's time for some 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air, like this one from Ace Even. I love this podcast, period. I had to update my review for the new cast. Alonzo, killing it as always. Treya, bringing the Midwestern voice hard. Iffy, my man, gotta have that JRPG talk. As much as I will miss Ricky in April, saddy face, this podcast will continue to be the one I must listen to each week to keep sane. You have no idea how much you all mean to me and a lot of others. Keep it up.
Well, thanks,
thank
Ace
you
Even.
So much. Oh my gosh, that was so nice of you. Ace Even, I did not see that coming.
Good on you then.
I know, Look, we're thankful for you. But before we go, I have to tell you about MaxFunStore.com. You can go there to buy all the Maximum Fun merch you ever wanted, including our incredible Who Shot Your Christmas ornament.
Which is good year-round, and also, if you, like me, do not celebrate Christmas, you can still have it. I'm going to hang it up.
It's a gorgeous thing.
Yeah,
it is a cool object. Yes, it'll look dynamite on your tree. But yeah, hang it from, you know, your lamp.
Put it on your cork board. Put it on your inspiration
rear view mirror.
Board.
You know, take those fuzzy dice off and put that ornament
there
up.
There we go.
Yes.
It's so cool. I'm so excited we have one.
I know. Well, it's a great gift for a fellow Who Shot Your listener around the holidays. And there are a bunch of other gifts for our other shows, too. So go check out MaxFunStore.com. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/ Who Shot Your Podcast. Or send us an email at whoshotya@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.